Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hello and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, they tell me that it's good for me, but I don't even care. I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
I'm Joe McCormick.
And I'm Holly Fry.
Yes, yes. Jonathan is out on vacation today, but Holly, being a fitness enthusiast, is joining us again. If you tuned into the last episode, you have already borne witness to our shenanigans.
And we're just tickled pink to have her.
We certainly are.
Pink, you say? My favorite color.
So we are continuing today to talk about fitness. We wanted to talk more about the science and what we know and what we absolutely don't know and how exciting all of this future research is going to be.
One thing that I think is amazing about fitness is this is such a basic issue, and there's so much that, like, we're still discovering and still haven't – things we still haven't settled.
Yeah.
It just blows my mind.
Well, sure. I mean, we've basically been human beings the way that we think of human beings for, you know, tens of thousands of years.
I think 200,000 years,
yeah.
I'd say, something like that.
And we're still really mystified by how our bodies work, which
yeah.
is, I mean, partially because of the fact that all of our bodies are very slightly different, which mucks things up. And there's
yeah.
a lot of factors involved, you know, what we're eating and where we're living and frog
the
radiation.
Variables are huge.
Science is unanimous that the best thing for us is to sit at a desk and watch YouTube all day.
Well, then I am set.
Fortunately.
Actually, that is not what science agrees is the best for us.
No, and we went into that in depth in the last episode. But Joe, can you recap it for
yeah,
us?
Yeah, really brief recap. Okay, so everybody needs exercise. You already know this, but just be assured it is a true science fact. Exercise is good for you. The U.S. Health Department recommends that all healthy adult individuals get a minimum of 150 minutes of moderate intensity aerobic activity every week, or 75 minutes of vigorous activity. So basically what that means is like 150 minutes of moderate intensity walking, say, where your heart rate's elevated a little bit, or lighter tasks like, you know, gardening and stuff like that. Or 75 minutes of, like, hard running or intense sport playing, something like that, plus two sessions of strength training per week. And how are we doing? Well, we're not quite getting there. Less than as of the first 6 months of 2012, less than half of American adults were meeting these were meeting just the goal for aerobic activity. And about, what was it, 20.7% of Americans between 25 and 64 are meeting both of these requirements for the aerobic activity and the strength training. So we're doing
kind of all right. Not as bad
okay,
as we could
not
be.
Great.
Not okay, not great. Yeah.
But we'd like to talk a bit about how science may inform the way we make fitness decisions in the future and reach our fitness goals and achieve greater performance and utter excellence and mystical power.
I can't wait. Can't wait for my mystical powers to kick in.
Tell us about your mystical powers, Holly.
I'm going to keep running and running and running until I can alter space with my mind.
Oh, wow.
That sounds pretty good.
That's you have a much bigger goal.
I really have none.
I think I have like a workout that couple times a week that Joe was talking about. That's my main goal right now, not bending the time-space continuum through my workouts.
Well, he promised me mystical powers. Hello.
Okay.
I'm working on a trick where I do push-ups, but I'm staying in place and moving the earth.
I think when you get there, I want to witness it. It's going to be cool.
All right. So this does all tie in to the science of motivations.
Mm-hmm.
Like we said a little bit in the last episode, you know, these are really important for how much exercise you wind up actually getting. And all sorts of things like the enjoyment, the challenges, you know, personal motivators like appearance and weight management and stress management can all be reasons that people work out. Those first two, the enjoyment and the challenge of it, tend to be really good indicators of adherence to exercise, which basically means that we should all be playing sports or gamifying things. Again, like we were saying in the last episode, that's pretty rad. The prefrontal cortex rules a lot of how motivated we are about stuff, because that's where we reason and make choices in response to stimuli. Unfortunately, this can kind of work against us, because being physically unfit means that it is harder to exercise and that people want to do it less. And as, you know, conversely, as you get more fit, you have better motivation because you're probably, you've fallen into a routine. You might have some kind of social contract going on. You're having fun.
And it also just feels better at that point.
Right.
You know,
sure.
Sometimes the startup has a lot of aches and pains to it, whether you have extra weight or not. Even people that look very fit sometimes aren't. And the startup is just painful and awful. And it's hard to sustain, you know, those first couple of weeks. No, I really want to keep going. But once you're into it and your body's accustomed to the movement, it feels better and you want to do it more.
Right, right. A lot of people talk also about the adrenaline rush that you'll get from pushing your muscles to a certain point, the runner's high.
Yeah, that's real. I'm not kidding. The first time it actually happened to me after I started running, I thought I was having a stroke. I'm not kidding. Like, I pulled my car over because I was like, there's no reason I should be this giddy for no utter reason. I'm just driving down the street. It was very bizarre and wonderful. Now I know what it is, and I know I am not experiencing a cerebral event of concern.
It's pretty amazing. It feels like, I felt it before, it feels like life is good and I want a burrito.
Mine was more like screechy happiness, like when you crest a roller coaster. Like, like it was very bizarre. You see why I pulled over. I was like, I might not be fit to conduct a vehicle at this time. But then it passed. It was getting okay.
So these are all kind of in-brain hormonal sort of things going on there. There is research that motivation might have a genetic component. There was a study done at the University of Missouri with two groups of rats that through breeding, they created one that really loved to run a lot and the other were just little ratty couch potatoes. Through a series of 10 generations of tracking how much rats in each breeding group enjoyed running, like how much, given the chance to, they would just run on their own, and interbreeding the two groups to greater exclusivity. So, I mean, that's with rats. Rats are not people. It's a little bit more complicated with people. Rats don't have as much, you know, like Buffy reruns to go through, for example. But
you'll just set it up so you can be on the treadmill and watch the Buffy rerun.
That's what I do. I turn on things that I want to watch, and I bop around my living room with free weights. That is my basic exercise mode.
If you're a wild rat, you really need to be getting exercise a lot, I would think, right?
Your choice is narrow in terms of your behavior options.
Yeah, like, there are no cats in America. Oh, we were wrong. <You know? laughs> It's time to run.
Where are these rats getting their information?
I don't know.
The streets are not, in fact, paved with cheese.
Someone told them there were no cats in America.
We were lied to.
Lies.
They thought they'd get to be couch potatoes,
deception.
And they were wrong.
It's a secret covert cat operation to misinform rats of other countries to come here. No, go to America. It's awesome.
Well, fortunately, we've really shut down the rat population intake through Ellis Island. It's really hard for a rat to get papers there anymore.
All the name changes were just awful.
Mouskowitz.
Yeah.
Anyway, so genetics is certainly a factor to not only how good we are base level at exercising, but also to whether or not we're motivated, but other motivators, again, like we were talking about in the last episode, is that emotional support thing. Mm. A meta review done by the Community Preventative Services Task Force of the CDC found that social support led to people being physically active in longer, more frequent sessions, and that they wound up improving their aerobic capacity, confidence, and knowledge, and decreasing their body fat percentages. So,
when?
So, I mean, that sounds like basic knowledge, but it's a science fact.
Yeah.
Furthermore, a series of four studies conducted at the University of Georgia here in town, published in 2010, found that self-control or the lack thereof is contagious across behaviors, which basically means that if you see people, Joe, you were talking about that a little bit in the last episode, wherein, you know, Kohler effect?
The Kohler effect.
Kohler effect, right, wherein...
If you're among a group of people performing better than you, it helps you.
Mm-hmm, sure. And you know, lots of other research backs this up. The Framingham Heart Study, which if you guys have never heard about, is my personal favorite medical research study. I get super excited about the outcomes from it because...
Tell us all about it.
This is spanning a community of over 15,000 people in Massachusetts from 1948 on. And so, I mean, all of these families living in this one town have just been tracked a whole bunch of their weight and health indicators forever. And there was one segment of research that occurred from 1971 through 2003, finding that obesity and healthy weight both appeared in social clusters. That you had an increased, a 57% increased chance of becoming obese if you have a friend who becomes obese within this time period. 57%. That's a lot.
That's significant.
Yeah, way significant. Hella significant. 40% if your sibling, if your adult sibling became obese. 37% if your spouse became obese. And so, yeah.
Wow.
So that social motivator is really intense, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's amazing that we're still learning these things.
Oh, right, right. And that, you know, and that it was a huge surprise when this research was published. It was like, oh dear. Oh my goodness, I shouldn't have taught that class on how to make mayonnaise. Like, you know, like that.
You should always teach a class on how to make mayonnaise. Yeah.
But do you all know when mayonnaise was invented?
I do not.
I don't either. But, you know,
some
it's a great
time.
Thing to wonder about.
Some magical
somewhere
time.
In France. Long ago.
Yeah, so we're still learning things like that. Like, Holly told me about something that absolutely blew my mind. Apparently, the question is not settled yet. What should you wear when you're running?
Well, oh, it's settled.
Oh.
It is settled by science now. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But this is a recent thing, actually.
Let me correct. Lots of people don't know.
Which is shocking to me. But only because I crave comfort in all things.
Explain clothes. And by the way, Holly explained earlier that she has a real love of the history of underwear. So maybe this will inform your...
I don't know that it will. Except I do have a... in history, I really love undergarments. I think they're fascinating as an indicator of cultural happenings. But in terms of fitness and running specifically, which is what I do a lot of, cotton is rotten. And there is this thing where people tend to think that natural fibers must be better. They're natural fibers, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, things that are natural are good.
But heads up, not so much when you're running, because cotton is very absorbent. But it is not so good at drying out.
But it comes from a plant. How could it be bad?
Because if you have a wet thing rubbing up against you for 13 miles, I'm going to put a safe bet that it's going to start to hurt and become uncomfortable and potentially give you a rash. Or
also, it's making that fabric heavier,
yes.
Which is lame.
Yes.
Scientifically lame.
I have taken on a lot of water during a run when I was wearing a costume, and I could tell you by the end of it, there was a lot of weight and pain.
I have a friend who, on one of his longest runs ever, that he was sort of forging new territory, and he ran a very long run that he had not done before. And at the end, his nipples were not in a happy place at all.
No, that's pretty common. This is one of those things that if you get into running, there's this whole secret world of information about
how
things
to prevent
that could go horribly wrong
many
with your person.
Like that. Yeah. And many kinds of products that are sold to perhaps lubricate things like your inner thighs and your nipples that might get chafed.
Yeah. The big one that most runners that I know use is called Body Glide. And it's basically like a... it looks like a deodorant stick. It's like a balm type thing that'll keep things from chafing so much. I have heard from friends in the military that they just use deodorant. It works exactly the same.
Okay.
Test as you will. But the thing about textiles and cotton in particular is that it will, as I said, it takes on water, but it's not very good at getting rid of that water. So it's just rubbing up against you and causing blisters if you have cotton socks, chafing on your clothes. And so there really has been this huge advancement in the last couple of decades in what is called sort of tech textiles. And basically they're made to wick away water. They pull it off of your skin and then it evaporates quickly. So you're not dragging it around or living in it.
This is due to the wonder of plastics.
It is. It's due to the wonder of plastics and of weaving. They're actually woven in a way that they will channel water in the most dissipating effect. So it keeps water from bulking up anywhere on the garment. It will
automatically... Getting a surface area great enough to maximize that evaporation effect.
Yeah, there's actually like the way that the weave comes off of the loom, and it's usually with polyester fibers, often with nylon involved. There are actual tiny tubes in the textile weave that kind of pull water away from any one spot. So it's physics. Always on the move. And that's as wonderful. You're running and that water is getting dissipated into thinner and thinner layers, it's evaporating much more quickly. There will often be an effect where it's kind of a clear thing to test it. So there are two things that are going on. One is this movement of water where they're circulating the water away from any one space. And two is the air circulation around you that's bringing it off. So that as you're running normally, you're creating wind currents around yourself, and that's helping. But if you ever want to test like this actually functioning with and without the wind portion of it, if you run in a small room on a treadmill, you are not going to dry off as quickly. Because there's just not as much air movement around you. Whereas if you go outside and do the exact same run in the exact same temperature in the same wicking garment, you will be dry much more quickly. And those will help keep you from getting horrible chafing misery. It helps with the nipple thing that boys get sometimes. Women usually are wearing sports bra, so it's less of an issue, right?
Yeah.
Yes, there's a whole other set of physics at work there. But yeah, and the textile industry is constantly sort of working to keep these fabrics advancing and getting better and better at their jobs. And some will keep you warm in cold climates, and others will keep you cool in hot climates. It's very fascinating and good stuff.
Some of the stuff I'm excited about, I think that you edited an article about this for How Stuff Works, Holly, was people who are integrating some of the biosensors into garments like this. And using so that you can wear a shirt that will A, wick your moisture away, and B, track your activity? Is that?
There are some. They're experimental. There's nothing on the market.
Right.
For anybody that watches Project Runway, many seasons back, there was a designer named Diana Eng, and she's actually from a science background. And she's done a lot of really interesting stuff working with various sensors and technologies. She worked on a hoodie some years back that had a camera in it that was in the top of the hood. So if you were wearing the hoodie, there was a heart monitor attached. And when your heart elevated past a certain rate, it would automatically take a picture. And her idea was one of an artistic concept of like, when you are excited, it will be taking a record of the things that excite you in your life. There are potential military applications to it that I think have been kind of investigated. I remember when it first came out, there was talk on various kind of nerdy textile message boards about the potential application of having people that were, for example, on parole wearing something like this, so that if it looked like they were likely to
knock over a convenience
once again,
store,
like
right.
go into a life of crime, mm-hmm. theoretically, their heart rate would rise and it would do it. But
there are textile message boards.
You don't even want to know.
Oh.
There's everything and anything you could ever imagine on the internet in message board form.
I was going to say, as another quick aside, that some of this technology, and I think this is on the market in Japan or Korea, that there are ears and tails that they sell that have little mini rotors in them that will react. Okay, that will react to your heart rate. When you get excited, your tail will wag or whatever. Yeah.
They have them at some anime conventions, you'll find them.
But that is getting away from
that's
fitness.
That's like a fun thing.
Right.
But from the fitness angle, it's a very short walk to envision things like that being integrated into your clothes to kind of track how you're doing and your health as you're doing it and your performance. And there are even clothes that are allegedly designed to keep you warm enough that your basal metabolic rate increases, like that you're burning more
calories faster
at all times, even when you're still. I haven't tested those.
I don't know. Some of those we're going to get in a minute into some of the kind of wackadoo waste of money sort of things that come out.
We're going to talk about bad exercise science too,
and that sounds like it's ranging very dangerously close to.
I wonder.
Sure, but
I want to talk about another issue I've heard about, and this is funny because people have opinions about this one.
Well, apparently. About everything related to fitness.
There is apparently some debate between people who favor running with shoes on versus people who favor running barefoot.
Oh, Christopher McDougall, what have you done to us?
I believe that of all...
Tell me the science facts.
All the terrible understatements that we make on this show, that is maybe one that I'm the most personally familiar with and terrified by. I don't even like saying the word barefoot on the internet anymore. It's like saying Nazis. It's awful. I mean, people get up in arms.
Whoa.
They do.
So...
Tell me,
Holly, you're entrenched in running communities. Mm-hmm. Do you have a personal recollection of when this whole thing got started and?
I mean, when it really exploded was when Christopher McDougall's book, which is called Born to Run, came out. And in it, it is a book that's about running, but also about cultural anthropology. And in it, he talks about the Tarahumara tribe of Mexico. And they are just culturally runners. They run for hundreds of miles at a time wearing nothing but like basically a piece of leather strapped to the bottom of their foot. And this sort of launched this big discussion about how, no, our bodies are actually designed biomechanically
to
run
cool with
without
running.
Big, crazy shoes made in a factory. You are made to be a runner. Yeah,
right.
You're made to be a runner. And so this must be the right way. These people run all the time. They're injury free. They must be doing it correctly. This started this huge movement where people were like, I'm throwing out my shoes. I mean, I personally have a brother of a close friend of mine who is an ultra marathoner. He will do 100-mile races. Mm-hmm. And
I know this is
a great idea. Yeah. And he ran out and ran like 22 miles and got a stress fracture. Because his body, while biomechanically we may be designed to do that on some level, if your whole life has not been spent that way and then you start running that way, that's not what your body does anymore.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not sold.
Okay.
Just as an outside observer, I mean, on that that evolutionary adaptation argument, I mean, there are all kinds of states of nature in which we are evolved to do certain things, but certainly we're healthier if we do them a different way.
Or at least more comfortable, or it's what we're used to. And I think that what we're used to is a larger factor most of the time. I mean, okay, so the actual biomedical end of this is that people who push for barefoot running say that it's that the most efficient way to run is to land on the forefoot or slightly into the midfoot.
Right.
Rather than heel striking being what a lot of these very padded shoes that became especially popular in the 1980s, and they really didn't become popular until the 1980s. Things like Chucks, Converse, were very popular as actual exercise shoes up through the 1970s.
Those really were for basketball and like heavy impact activities.
And not for hipsters like me, right. Yeah. I mean, they didn't wear them to the office. Or, I mean, I guess they could have, but
wearing them right now.
I am wearing
them right
now.
I live in my Chucks. But,
I mean, they're great. They're super comfortable.
Yeah.
But
I cannot imagine running in them.
I do not want to do that, no. And proponents of barefoot running say that we are, right, like more likely to strain our tendons and ligaments and wind up causing either more immediate injuries or long-term skeletal issues by doing all of this crazy heel striking.
And they also will say that our feet would naturally be stronger and able to handle our own weight if we had not munched them up by wearing shoes all the time to train in.
Right. Okay. So the actual research says that, yes, minimal running will encourage you to strike in the fore and midfoot more so than...
Which is actually my natural stride.
That's awesome.
I've
good
never
for you.
Been a heel striker.
That is maybe why you are better at running than I am, or more motivated to run.
I have really good natural endurance, and I think it's because I don't tend to get injuries from it that mm-hmm. I get some other injuries, but
sure.
I haven't had like impact issues. I haven't had shin splints.
Mm-hmm. My knees are terrible, but, and also other,
I don't know why I'm making Joe laugh.
No, when you said other injuries, I just imagined from like, you know, knife tricks. Or
no, I can tell you, I do get running injuries. I have tendonitis and it's because I weigh too much to run as much as I do.
Oh, okay.
It has caused some things to tighten up in ways they shouldn't, and I have tendonitis.
Well.
And a really good physical therapist.
Well, excellent.
Good.
Science, y'all. And also walking studies have found that for people, these studies have been done in people with arthritis and rheumatisms involved in their feet, legs, and knees. With knees in particular, You should walk, if you've got issues with your knees in particular, these studies say you should definitely walk barefoot as much as possible because, any kind of sole is going to lead to worse impact and more injuries. Those are the two things that I've seen people agree upon. Everything else, including whether or not it causes less strain or potential injury in the short and or long term, I've seen research that says it both ways.
Yeah.
That some studies say that a forefoot strike will help you disperse the impact of running better and therefore let you run better on harder surfaces without discomfort. But some found increased arch strain and plantar flexor force while forefoot striking.
Yes.
However, less Achilles tendon strain and knee flexation. Yep. So it goes both ways. Who knows?
Plantar fasciitis right here.
There you go.
There is also sort of an interesting middle ground that doesn't have so much to do with the footwear called chi running.
Yeah.
And it kind of it has been around much longer than this whole barefoot running thing, which exploded. And the idea behind that is very pro forefoot striking, midfoot striking, really, and kind of about handling where your body weight falls during your stride. But they are not telling anyone to throw their shoes away. So it kind of is a meet in the middle place for a lot of people.
Right, sure. It's more correcting your stride and working on that, working on being aware of your stride than trying to use shoes or the lack thereof to change it. Artificially,
yeah.
Which is where I think that, I mean, because research has definitely showed that if you make a change and expect to just go out and run the way that you always have been, that you're going to hurt yourself. So,
yeah. And even proponents of barefoot running will say,
oh, absolutely. Right.
Run half a mile. Even if you are a marathoner, only run half a mile this way at first and build up, because it is a completely different set of muscles that get engaged in your foot.
Right, right. Part of this debate also gets into whether or not it's more bodily economical, in terms of your oxygen and calorie usage to run, barefoot or not. And that also has to do more with where the foot is striking than anything else. And research also disagrees on whether or not forefoot versus hindfoot striking is going to do that thing. And even pronation, which is a thing that people have been talking about. Pronation is how much your foot rolls when you land. And I guess when you land and then uplift again.
Yeah, it's basically your whole stride cycle from where you impact the ground to leave the ground.
Mm-hmm. But it's a side-to-side roll more than a front-to-back roll. And even that, you know, which we have been taught for years that, you know, if you over-pronate or under-pronate that you need special shoes, science is like, eh.
My personal experience is not eh, but...
But again...
Because I'm a pronator.
Yeah.
And I will say, for anybody that runs, if you've never been fitted for running shoes, that is a fabulous technological adventure. Because they will literally, like, put you... Good places that do it. And running shoe stores will often have this tech on hand, and they'll do it. And they'll put you on a treadmill and videotape you, and then they'll still step through that and show you where your foot is moving at every portion of your stride. And then they'll put you on a balance board to see where your body weight naturally distributes anyway. And you get to see a beautiful readout display of the hot spots where you're heaviest on your feet. And then they will help you select shoes. And for me, that made a big difference. But again, your mileage may vary, as with anything involving fitness.
Mm-hmm. These results are not reproducible in laboratory settings, I think, is the official line. So, yeah.
Well, and part of that, I think, is you would have to monitor the subjects for years and years and years.
Which is part of, yes, the problem.
Yeah.
And that no one has a Framingham Heart study of running a lot. So.
Yeah, especially you would have to get runners just as they're starting to get into running, and like 5 years later and 10 years later, and how their injuries have or have not happened. And which is great. Somebody do that study. I'll read it.
Yeah.
In 10 years when you're done.
Yep.
Okay, so I want to talk about one more controversial frontier.
Oh, buddy.
What?
No, I'm excited about controversy.
Have y'all heard of the drugs?
the drugs?
The drugs.
Someone on the corner the other day was telling me about those.
Yeah. Sometimes drugs can help you get better gains in exercise, but obviously most or all of these drugs come with bad side effects that are worse than the gains you get in your performance. And the question is, are there any drugs that are basically innocuous enough and helpful enough to be, on the whole, good for your health?
Actually, I think caffeine is maybe something that most people could agree is generally okay for boosting your performance a little bit.
Yeah, you will be able to go a little longer, push a little harder. In terms of percentage, I don't have an exact number, but it's not crazy.
We should...
It's a single digit, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we should absolutely preface this discussion by saying we are not doctors.
Nope.
We are not health professionals, and we are absolutely not making recommendations.
No. Before you make any dietary or certainly drug-related change to your self.
Your whole regimen.
Your whole regimen, right.
You should
yeah.
get a pro in the mix.
Yeah,
right.
yeah.
Consult a physician.
Talk to a physician, a nutritionist, a priest, whatever you need to do. but caffeine has been found, it has not been found to improve your oxygen capacity, but right, like Holly was saying, it can let you to train at greater power and or for longer. It also doesn't have an effect on maximal strength, but can increase your endurance or resistance to fatigue. So,
See, that's why my endurance is so good. I drink like 10 cups of coffee a day.
She does. It's crazy, y'all.
It's not even an exaggeration.
It's not.
Gross.
I think you meant awesome, but it's okay. Sometimes we all misspeak.
I meant awesome.
It's fine.
And it's also been, it also has not been shown to have a significant dehydration effect on athletes. So,
because usually you're guzzling
fluids
as well.
Right. As long as you are intaking enough water, which is really important and you should do anyway, then you should be totally fine. And furthermore, the amounts that most athletes would take are not at the range that people would start talking about doping and that. I mean, it's all
right.
Doping, but it's not the kind of thing that the Olympics committee would have to get into.
Well, they even sell, for endurance athletes, you know, you will often buy little like gels or goo or some sort
whatever
of
food nutrient
thing
pack
that
yeah.
you will have like at some point during your long distance training or races. And they even make, Jelly Belly actually makes these things called sport beans that have like your electrolytes and, you know, you get a sugar boost. And they actually do make a caffeinated version of them. For runners.
Birdie Botts has not told me anything about this. This is...
Of the sport bean?
Of the sport bean.
I always have some sport beans for a race. Because I like them because they're easy to handle.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
I can just...
And they sound less gross than the gel packs. The gel packs are pretty gross.
I can't stomach the gel packs.
Okay, so y'all seem to basically be saying that as far as you're aware, that there aren't any major medical risks to using caffeine to enhance your workout somewhat?
Not at the level that you would want to use caffeine at. I think yeah. like anything, if you and you know, and clearly something like straight caffeine is more effective than drinking a cup of coffee or whatever, but yeah, I mean, I think that you would have to consume way more of it than you would want to really have a negative effect.
Okay. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum and talk about some stuff that I think the verdict is in on, and they say you really shouldn't use these. How about anabolic steroids?
Oh, I had a bunch for lunch. No, I would not.
Those are bad, kids.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes they can be prescribed for medical reasons.
Well, absolutely. And steroids are actually extremely useful in people who have, again, those diseases in the arthritis and rheumatism kind of categories mm-hmm. for helping your joints. It's an anti-inflammatory, so it's going to help all of your bones and joints work more smoothly and decrease inflammation in them, which is rad for everybody.
Yeah.
But those are in extremely, extremely small and occasional amounts.
And even those doses, sometimes people have
negative effects.
Mood swings are not uncommon, like mm-hmm. with corticosteroids, which are often prescribed for an inflammatory issue. So even in the small amounts that aren't maybe physically dangerous in any way, there's still some negativity to them. So once you get to the heavy hitter dosages that we're discussing, or about to, I think, you're really looking at some danger zones.
Yeah, I've got a list of risks associated with anabolic steroids in a little rundown by the Mayo Clinic. They say that some risks, both men and women might experience severe acne, risk of tendinitis or tendon rupture, problems with your liver or tumors, basically putting your cholesterol levels exactly the opposite of where you want them, so increasing the bad cholesterol and decreasing the good. Cardiovascular problems,
high blood pressure, hypertension,
definitely hypertension, and aggression, as well as other.
We don't need you any more aggressive, Joe. Pretty poof.
Yeah, I know. I scare people sometimes.
So steroids have two basic effects on the body. You've got the anabolic effects, which promote the muscle building and are going to affect your cardiovascular system and all that kind of fun stuff. And then you've got the androgenic effects, which are affecting sexual characteristics mm-hmm. and depending on how your chromosomes lay out.
Yeah.
And so, for example, men can develop prominent breasts. Or shrunken testicles, or infertility, or impotence. Women can develop deeper voices, enlarged clitorises, increased body hair, also baldness. It's, I mean, unfun times.
Super delightful side effects.
Generally.
Not so much.
For most, I mean, you might be into that, and I absolutely do not want to pass any kind of character judgment. But, for most people
do not want those things.
I don't think that, yeah.
The jury's in, do not take anabolic steroids unless they've been prescribed by your doctor.
That's not really a huge news flash.
No, not at all. What about, have y'all heard of creatine?
Oh, yeah.
Creatine, right? Your body makes it naturally.
So it has to be good for you as much as possible,
they
right?
They sell it in health food stores.
Should it, okay, so this is another, this is sort of middle of the road, right? This isn't anabolic steroids. It's not something that's this big, scary thing.
Okay, so what creatine does in your body, I believe, is it helps your muscles make more ATP, which is a really long word. ATP. It's stuff what stores and transports energy in your cells, yeah?
It's adenosine triphosphate.
Excellent. Cool. Your powers of reading are stronger than mine, Joe. Thank you. And so sometimes
it's because he's been hitting the creatine, he's really at the ready.
So people will take it to provide themselves with bursts of energy for, say, like weightlifting or other. Usually, I think it's strength intensive.
Yeah,
folks who
I don't know many endurance people that have even ever discussed it.
Right.
Usually when I have heard it mentioned, it's amongst my friends that are really going for strength gains.
Yeah, it is naturally you intake it through things like meat and other proteins and your body
liver produces it naturally.
Mm-hmm. And will also get rid of any excess, which I think is above
kidneys.
Yes. Yeah, above like 2 grams per day is what your body is like. That's enough, guys.
And so because this is one of the things that your kidneys have to get rid of is that, you know, you pee it out. If you take too much of it, this can put you at risk for problems with your kidneys and potentially with your liver, too. And so that's a potential risk. But this is another thing where it seems to be somewhere in the middle. It doesn't seem like it's just this obvious big no-no, but I'm not sure if we could say it's clear that the benefits outweigh the cost, so it's probably best to just talk to your doctor about it.
Right, especially since some of those costs can decrease your athletic performance, you know, by giving you stomach and muscle cramps, nausea, diarrhea, and weight gain. But in addition to those, I mean, you know, basically the jury is out on, and you know, sometimes literally on what larger doses of this can do. There have been a bunch of lawsuits recently about, you know, people have had very adverse effects and have sued some of the companies that create some of the supplements.
Yeah, but there's apparently a link between creatine supplements and alleged resulting kidney failure. I think this is not fully understood yet, and the thing is we apparently don't know the long term effects of using supplements like these, and especially the danger would probably be in using large amounts of them. But in any case, it's definitely something that again you would want to talk to your doctor before using.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And especially, certainly in large doses.
Yeah.
Did you have any others? Any other exciting ones, Joe?
Yeah, I had another interesting one. Have y'all heard of a drug called modafinil?
It rings a bell, but I couldn't
AKA
conjure it.
Provigil?
Does that make you extra vigilant?
basically, yeah. So you can read about this drug all over the web, and the web is full of maybe sometimes kind of creepy people, but you know, people who are
judgmental.
See, I was going to say no, not online, never. So
some biohacker types, people who are interested in messing with their bodies to see what they can do. And so this drug originally was designed, the generic term is modafinil, and it was a psychostimulant designed to treat narcolepsy and sleep disorders.
Mm-hmm.
But what ended up happening is that people started discovering apparently, and I haven't used this drug or anything, like so I can't comment from personal experience, people report that it has benefits apart from just helping with the sleep disorders. People, in fact, treat it like a kind of life-enhancing drug. So they claim that they use it to get all kinds of crazy work done that they couldn't get done otherwise, but without a lot of the negative side effects that you'd experience from a traditional stimulant.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we want to stress, do not take our little story here and say, oh, I'm going to go get some of that. This is something that definitely should be prescribed by a doctor. If you're going to use it, and it, but it also apparently manifests in terms of gains in endurance with exercise. Mm. There was a 2004 study called "Effects of Acute Modafinil Ingestion on Exercise Time to Exhaustion," and what this found is that this drug, which apparently, again, there are these apocryphal reports, are it's pretty safe apparently without a lot of known side effects. Causes people to get much better workouts before exhaustion. Like it sort of delays the onset of perceived exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
People don't realize they're fatigued, so they can go farther, get more exercise, get a better workout each time.
Which has its upsides and downsides. There are a lot of, I mean, I think that Holly is pretty with me on the crazy hippie stance of you should do what's pretty natural for you when you're exercising. You have to do
mostly
it in that voice, though. But a lot of people will say that, you know, if your pain centers are what tell you when you are hurting yourself, and that sounds obvious, but sometimes a lot of this FITSPO kind of thing that happens, FITSPO being Fitspiration, being that entire concept of pasting a photo up on your fridge of a fitness model with the saying, like, when it hurts, hit it harder, or something like that. And, you know, of course, the hilarity being that fitness model is literally paid to look like that, and unless you are also literally paid to look like that, probably you're not gonna.
And it might be retouched.
And it might be retouched. Furthermore, you
don't... They're probably also bad people.
You know, no. Right? They probably kick puppies.
Well, I'm reluctant to say, yeah, because there is a level at which, you know, you want to be comfortably uncomfortable. Like, you want to be pushing past
absolutely
comfort and delight to a point where your body is challenged, because that is how you make fitness gains.
Exactly.
But there are people that take that to a very extreme level and kind of become really delighted in self-abuse. And I think when you're talking about a drug that doesn't let you register where your body is actually at in terms of exhaustion, and
that sounds like bad to me.
Yeah, it seems like a recipe for potential just disaster.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's another perspective.
What you really hear is the subtext of Joe going, hippies.
No, again, I am not recommending people use this drug. I just found it interesting, and I'd like to read more research on it.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm curious, since it requires a doctor's prescription, how many doctors are willing to prescribe it for its off-label use of this sort of life hack approach?
Yeah, there was actually a New York Magazine profile about modafinil use from this past spring. And it commented on how apparently there was a great increase in use of this drug over the past decade. And what's estimated is that apparently most of this was for off-label use.
Yeah, there probably was not a correlating increase in cases of narcolepsy in New York.
I would hope not. If there were, then I really want to run some social factors on what was causing all that
narcolepsy. There's some other things at play there.
Yeah. All right. So we've talked about a bunch of stuff that you shouldn't do for exercise. Is there anything that people can do safely that we want to actually... I mean, as much as we're not doctors, we're not fitness professionals, we can't make actual literal medical recommendations to you. I mean, up to and including, like, don't use weight loss pills and electric shock belts, y'all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of crazy stuff on the internet people are trying to sell you about how to get fit and lose weight. And, you know, I hate to say this because I'm sure this will cut out some totally decent stuff too, but just in general, if it's on an ad, it doesn't work. Don't look at it. It's just going
it
to
does work,
it's just going to pollute
some scary
your brain.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anything being sold to you in an infomercial, anything very expensive or overly complicated is probably just that. It's probably a gimmick. And you know, being used to sell something rather than to actually make people more fit.
One weird trick, but
well, those come up on the internet all the time, and specifically on social media, the one thing that gets rid of belly fat, and they want you to click through. And
yeah, I mean, and I can tell you what
giving them money.
The one weird thing that gets rid of belly fat is eating less and exercising more.
What?
And I know that information sucks. I know that nobody wants to hear that you have to eat fewer calories and burn more calories in order to lose weight. But that's basically what it is, you guys. And you know, like I said, Holly and I are kind of hippies. I personally recommend working out with mostly your own body weight as the resistance. I'm really into that kind of thing. I think it's great to use less equipment, that you're cutting out potential for injury and overwork if you do. But
I like weight training. Body weight too, but I like weight training.
Some weight training, I mean, it depends on what effects you're trying to get. You know, the downside, of course, to resistance training is that you will only ever have as much weight to work with as you carry on your body, which can be a downside if you want to lift more than your body weight.
Yeah. What if I want to lift a refrigerator? I need to practice with a refrigerator.
No, we
fact.
Okay, we've learned some things here. We've got some good stuff. We got social reinforcement is good.
Yeah.
We've got gamification is good. We've got textile science advances. Use your wicking materials, right?
Yeah.
We've got a debate that's probably not settled about what you should do with your feet, but I guess do what works for you.
Basically, yeah, do what works for you is really good advice for that one.
We've got a strange discussion about drugs. Generally, I'd just say the best recommendation is probably avoid it unless for some reason your doctor tells you to take some kind of drug.
And make sure that's a real doctor, not like a duck that you've prescribed.
It's not Dr.
with a
Nick.
Doctor voice. Right. No. No. Not.
Okay.
And yeah, you know, like
facts.
Like reward yourself, not with food if you are trying to lose weight. That can be less than effective. Cut yourself slack. I mean, you know, like Holly said, sometimes it's easy to get into a pattern of not working out, but if you miss a couple, don't worry about it. Stressing yourself out is the opposite of the point.
Yeah. Back on the horse, it's fine.
Mm-hmm. You know, you can help yourself be on the horse by writing down your plans and tracking them. Fitness trackers can help with that. Do a little bit here and there rather than really stressing yourself out about doing all the exercise at a prescribed time every day. And yeah, do it with friends. Have fun doing it. Yeah.
We just saved the future.
But
we'll all be fit and able to run marathons in the future.
In the future?
The incredible future. Well, if you want to join us there, I think this pretty much wraps it up. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah? So you can go to forwardthinking.com. That is where you can find all of our other audio episodes, videos, blog posts. You can let us know what you thought of this very podcast. And, yeah, also on Twitter and the Facebooks, where you can find us at Forward Thinking. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.